Welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name's Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. Preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons has emerged to be one of the key foreign policy priorities of the Obama administration. Despite efforts among Western powers to form a united front in trying to pressure Iran to become more transparent with its nuclear program, questions remain regarding Tehran's true intentions, and talk of war has become increasingly louder in Western media. In an effort to resolve the issue, President Obama increased the pressure on Iran on December 31, 2011, by signing into law the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, a move which laid the groundwork for a policy banning any state from transactions with the Central Bank of Iran. The policy in effect prohibits the signing or continuation of oil contracts with Iran and any third country or company that wants to continue to deal simultaneously with the United States. The stated aim of the move was to lower the amount of Iranian oil sold on the international market, with the hope that the reduced revenue flow might motivate Tehran's government to answer outstanding questions regarding its nuclear program. Just a few weeks after the move was announced, the European Union added that unless Iran acceded to UN demands, it too would freeze Iranian financial assets and end all oil contracts by July. While this embargo is welcomed by Washington, the US needs to ensure that other key Iranian oil importers sign up if the policy is going to be effective. With much of Iran's oil sold on the Asian market, the US has since been working hard to persuade partners in the region to lower imports of Iranian oil as much as possible. As a close ally of the US and a country with a clear commitment to nuclear non-proliferation, South Korea has a strong impetus to go along with international efforts to reduce oil imports from Iran. However, as an energy-importing country that obtains nearly 10% of its oil supplies from Iran each year, South Korea is in a difficult position. In an effort to better understand the situation and choices that South Korea now faces, Korean Context spoke to Matthew Kronig of the Council on Foreign Relations, Dr. Balbina Hwang of Georgetown University, Philip Yoon of the Plowshares Foundation, and Tim Buschma of the German Marshall Fund. I started by asking Matthew Kronig to explain why the international community is currently so concerned about Iran's nuclear program.
Iran has claimed that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. The rest of the international community has good reason to believe that they have nuclear weaponization in mind. And so, as the U.S. intelligence community has pointed out, we have no firm evidence that Iran has yet made a final decision to build nuclear weapons. But that's somewhat misleading. I think all the circumstantial evidence suggests that they are interested in weaponizing eventually. So, for example, in the International Atomic Energy Agency's November report, they detailed a lot of research that Iran has been doing on nuclear weapons design. That's clearly not the kind of work you would need to do if you're only interested in energy.
So with concerns on Iran's nuclear program rising, what can the international community do?
There are only three ways that this issue is going to be resolved. The first would be some kind of diplomatic settlement. Second would be that we acquiesce to a nuclear-armed Iran. And the third would be that we take military action designed to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. So the last two options are obviously unattractive. A nuclear-armed Iran would pose grave threats for international peace and security. A military strike would also have some devastating consequences in terms of Iranian retaliation, potential spikes in oil prices. And so we're really putting all of our efforts at this point in the first basket, trying to get a diplomatic solution. But the Iranians have been unwilling to talk about their nuclear program, and so we've been following this pressure track, trying to increase pressure on Iran, increase sanctions on Iran, to try to compel them to come to the negotiating table. And so those sanctions have gotten more burdensome over time, and Iran is very dependent on exports, oil exports in particular. And so over the past few months, we've really tried to clamp down on oil exports. But the four biggest importers of Iranian oil are China, India, Japan, and South Korea. So getting those four countries on board is very important. And so right now, the United States is reaching out, especially to our partners, Japan and South Korea, to try to convince them to reduce their imports of Iranian oil. We're also reaching out with China and India, have had less success. But in order for these sanctions to work, in order to put really serious pressure on Iran, in order to concentrate their minds and get them to come to the negotiating table, we need these sanctions to be as comprehensive as possible. So if the South Koreans can reduce their imports of Iranian oil, that should help us to achieve our overall objectives. And while it's costly, it's less costly than the alternatives of either letting Iran have nuclear weapons or of military action in the Gulf.
But what is different about these sanctions compared to previous ones? Tim Bersma, an EU energy expert from the German Marshall Fund, explained.
I think the big difference is that the European Union agreed to participate now in oil-related sanctions. And that means they're going to pay a price for the measures. And the Europeans are in particularly paying that price because they're importers of crude oil from Iran. And in addition, the measures create bigger uncertainty on the markets, which will raise prices of oil, and the natural gas prices are related to it will go up as well. And I think in the end, European industry and consumers are paying a price for these measures, and I think that's what makes them different. On the other side, you could argue this could be a way to really put pressure on the Iranian regime, since it finances roughly about half its budget through oil revenues. So in the end, if the embargo is really taking effect and it gets the total effect it is aimed to get, it could really hurt the regime.
So if Europe is happy to pay the price, shouldn't South Korea go along with the US-led oil sanctions? Dr. Balbina Huang explains Seoul's connections with Tehran.
Well, first, we have to understand that South Korea's relationship with Iran goes back decades. And in fact, Iran has been a very important economic and trading partner for South Korea. In the 1970s, of course, South Korean companies were some of the most important ones that helped to industrialize Iran, worked on many of their big, large, heavy, capital-intensive projects. And anybody that knows Korea knows that one of the busiest thoroughfares in downtown Seoul is named in honor of that. It's called Tehran Row. So that is surprising, I think, to many Americans and Westerners. Korean large chaebol have a very large presence, not just in Iran, but in the Middle East. And in fact, Iran is South Korea's third largest trading partner in the Middle East, or was as of in 2010, totaling about $10 billion. And that's exclusive of the oil. So these are not insignificant amounts. Now, having said that, I think it's been very clear for a long time, not just with this Obama administration, but since the end of the Bush administration, that sanctions on Iran and tightening, especially of financial and economic levers on Iran, were coming down the pike. So this tension and these methods of tools that the United States is using to pressure Iran is not new. They've been essentially moving in that direction for a decade. So it should not have come as a surprise to Korea or Japan, frankly, the other of America's allies in Asia. And so I think that South Korea certainly has had time to prepare, both politically and in some ways economically, for this tightening and for basically a movement away from Iran and economic relations with Iran, and not just on the oil imports.
But with South Korea's participation in North Korea sanctions having made little difference to Pyongyang's nuclear program, would Seoul's participation in new Iran oil sanctions and financial restrictions make a difference this time around? Philip Yoon.
Okay, well, it depends on the level of analysis when you talk about financial sanctions, okay? The first one is it actually blocking transactions, or does it have the capability of blocking transactions? And I think that in the bank transactions do have that potential. I think it's very clear. I think we were talking about North Korea, the financial sanctions, financial transactional sanctions that were imposed did have an effect. Whether it was really intended to be the way that the United States did or not, that remains in question. But I think they clearly did have an effect on the flow of money that was coming in and coming out. Mm-hmm. The second thing is it affecting in some way the general population? And I think very clearly it is. And, you know, these are just sort of anecdotal reports that we hear from folks about how that, what those sanctions are and how they're affecting sort of the general population in terms of what they can do on an everyday basis. And I think the financial transactions are another, something that, will affect everyone's lives. Will it, then the other level is, does it affect the elite and the policymakers, you know? And is it, and some of those that are specifically aimed at them. And I think, you know, I think the guess is probably, you know, because they're gradually expanding and widening. The key question is whether or not it's going to have effect on actual policy. And that's not really clear. Okay. Because what has to happen for sanctions to work, they have to be very carefully designed and judiciously, I think, connected to, in my own view, diplomacy.
Yeah.
And there has to be a clear understanding in certain ways that if sanctions are lifted, that, you know, things will return to normal. And so it's not entirely clear. And, you know, part of it also has to do, it has to do what people perceive as the intent of the sanctions. And if the larger picture, the sanctions, if the Iranians perceive that what we're trying to do is actually change the regime, and they're most concerned about regime survival, then I think they're going to have some limited effect. But if it's very clear that this is aimed at the nuclear piece of what we're nuclear weapons program, and that's ultimately what we're concerned about, okay, then I think they do have the possibility of being quite effective.
As Yoon alludes to, the new Iran sanctions that the US wants South Korea to participate in might not only affect the leadership in Tehran, but the public too. Matthew Kronig explained the intention of this.
If the populace is hurt enough by the sanctions, blames the government for bringing the economic crisis on the country, that we could get some kind of indigenous regime change in Iran. The Arab Spring could finally make its way to Iran, and we'd get a change in government in Iran that would perhaps be more willing to negotiate on the nuclear program than the current government is.
However, not everybody agrees that things will change so easily. Tim Bursma.
In Iran, there's a big stream of people that would like this regime to change. We've seen the outcomes of that big mass demonstrations in 2009, but we've also seen the other side to it, that it was all smashed down. So in all honesty, there is a limit to what the people will take, surely, but on the other hand, this regime has shown that it does not really have that much of, you know, accountability. It can smash down demonstrations, mass demonstrations, and there's no reason to assume that it will not again. I wouldn't expect, although I do think there's a big part of Iranian Persian society that would favor a regime change, just as a lot of people. I'm not very optimistic about the speed at which this will happen, I guess.
But before any effect on the Iranian leadership can be felt, the sanctions would actually have to bite. I wondered if there would be any point in South Korea taking part in these new sanctions if other major oil importing countries like China and India avoided participating.
I think it is going to be tougher to get China and India on board than South Korea and Japan. But I don't think it's right to say that the sanctions won't work if China and India don't get on board. So clearly, if we can take Iranian oil off the market completely, Iran can't find buyers for its oil, that's going to have the biggest impact on the Iranian economy. But even if we can get everyone on board except China and India, that will still hurt Iran's economy and still reduce the revenues going into Iran. Because what will happen then is that China in particular, I think, will realize that there are fewer buyers for Iranian oil. So it has less competition, so it can negotiate a discount. And so oil experts, energy experts are saying that China might be able to import Iranian oil at maybe 10%, 15% below market prices. And so that would mean that Iran would be taking a 10 to 15% cut on all the oil it exports. So clearly, taking Iranian oil off the market completely would have a greater effect on Iran's economy. But even if we can get as many countries on board as possible and get the remaining, put the remaining buyers in a place to negotiate a discount, that's still going to reduce the revenues going into Iran and still contribute to our objectives.
Balbina Huang added her perspective.
It is clear that sanctions alone never work. History has shown that. Having said that, What we do know is sanctions are absolutely guaranteed not to work if states do not participate in them. So the point is here is not really whether or not will sanctions work. Will they succeed in getting Iran, for example, to give up its nuclear weapons? Or will it force the current government out of Iran? And will it force Iran to open up or liberalize or change their government? No, probably not. But that is, I believe, the wrong test of what we want to achieve with sanctions. At the very least, a strong coalition, a strong community, international community, that sends a message to Iran certainly will have some effect. And I think that's where Seoul right now is in a position of saying, are they going to go with the flow of where the international community is going, or are they going to stand on the other side? Now, South Korea clearly has a dilemma in terms of its own national interests, precisely because it is dependent on Iran for oil imports, but also because of its economic and business relations. Nevertheless, those costs in the immediate term to South Korean citizens, meaning the price, consumer prices may go up, oil prices may go up. Those hardships, I think, ultimately will be worth it in terms of the political costs and diplomatic costs for South Korea to join whatever sanctions are being placed by the international community.
To complicate things for South Korea is the situation north of the DMZ. Dr. Hwang explained.
Now, given where we are with North Korea, and the nuclear standoff that we have with North Korea, makes it very difficult for Seoul because they cannot be seen as essentially aiding and abetting Iran, precisely because of these ties to North Korea. In addition, whatever stance they take against North Korea has to be done then in relationship also with the stances that they take on Iran. I don't think Seoul can afford to be seen as less than resolute and strong in joining international sanctions or pressure on Iran, precisely because South Korea needs the rest of the world to join that kind of community against North Korea.
If North Korea wasn't enough, then another motivating factor for South Korea to take part in the sanctions might come down to the phenomenon known as Global Korea. Philip Yoon.
The current government, and I think the governments that will come after the Myeongbak government leaves power, is going to be thinking about South Korea's global position. Mm-hmm. South Korea is really positioning itself now as it's a developed country. It's a member of the OECD, and it's realizing that it has to think more in terms of a global player. And so as a result of that, you have seen in the past where they have done certain things that I think is consistent with being someone that has a more global perspective. I mean, Myeongbak has talked about global Korea, right, in business. Mm-hmm. But you look at what they've done with respect to the Iraq War, what they've done with other sort of international organizations. So I think that they are going to do whatever they can to comply with the wishes of the international community and will be part to shape it. But I also think that the United States and others are going to realize that, there's a certain degree of foreign dependency, so it can't happen right away.
While it's true that it would have been unfeasible for South Korea to stop all imports immediately, the European Union have already announced that they would be doing just this by July 1st. I asked Tim Bursmeier what lessons South Korea might be able to learn from Europe's position on Iran.
Right. I think that's difficult. I would say that, I mean, lessons would almost imply that it were a successful strategy. I think it's quite early to call it successful. So what you could argue two ways. You could say the Asian countries could join this initiative, demonstrate solidarity. And there are ongoing talks in Japan and Taiwan, South Korea as well. Of course, people thinking about whether or not to back this embargo. And as we know already, and the Europeans are experiencing at the moment, this comes with a price. There's an interesting difference between the US and Europe. I would say that the United States does not have any direct economic relations with Iran, and Europe does. So Europe is in fact feeling this much more than the United States is at the moment. In the end, the net effect of growing uncertainty in global oil markets will affect the United States as well. Prices go up. to be very honest, you could also argue, you know, we can all afford this. I mean, we're still going to drive our cars and prices will go up at the pumps, but at the end of the day, we can all afford it. And you could argue the same for the Asian countries involved. I mean, people in Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, etc., could easily afford that as well. I'm a little skeptical about the net effect in the long run, as long as China and India are buying up the oil from Iran, which they're currently doing, and they probably will keep on doing because they will get a very nice price from the Iranians because they've got to sell it somewhere. And in fact, they are the laughing thirds, this whole quarrel. And as long as they're going to keep buying this, I mean, you could very much doubt about, you know, the net effect this will have in the end, these measures will have.
So while it's difficult to tell if sanctions will make Iran change course with regard to its nuclear program, one thing is for certain, South Korea will have to pay a price to go along with the sanctions. But already, Iran is threatening to close the Straits of Hormuz, a channel which transports 80% of South Korean oil supplies. This could also have a major impact on oil prices for South Korea.
Iran has threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz a number of times, and so that could be something that it does in response to sanctions. Or if we get to the point of needing to take military action, that would be one of the ways in which they could retaliate militarily. So Iran does have the capability to close the Strait of Hormuz, but not for very long. So they would close it, but the United States military would quickly reopen it. And what that means, though, is military conflict between the United States and Iran. The Strait of Hormuz doesn't have an on-off switch. The way Iran would close the strait would be to lay mines, to attack ships going through the strait using anti-ship ballistic missiles they have on shore or using the Navy. So then the way the United States would reopen the strait would be to essentially destroy Iran's Navy, destroy these anti-ship ballistic missiles on shore. So it would mean a pretty intense military conflict. But U.S. defense planners estimate that it would take us about 3 weeks to reopen the strait. So it would be an intense conflict, but it would be over quickly. So what it would mean for oil prices is interesting. I was actually talking to some people who do energy market stuff last night. And so many people assume that a military conflict would be the worst in terms of oil prices and oil supplies. And they actually said that, you know, it's unclear whether sanctions or military conflict would have the greater overall effect on the global economy. Because they said what sanctions do is gradually increase oil prices around the world, which chokes off some economic growth for a sustained period of time as long as the sanctions are in place. What a military conflict would do, is, as you rightly point out, would probably close off the Strait of Hormuz for 3 weeks, which would mean, you know, a pretty large chunk of the global oil supply isn't making it to market. So it could mean $175, $200 a barrel for a few weeks. But once the straits were open, that would come down to roughly normal prices again. And so I think that there are economic consequences either way here. No matter how we put pressure on Iran, it's going to result in an increase in oil prices.
In a recent Foreign Affairs article entitled Time to Attack Iran, Matthew Kronig outlined his case for ending Iran's nuclear program through a military intervention. I asked him to explain why Obama would soon be faced with choosing between either containing a nuclear Iran or attacking it.
Well, I think that the point at which we'll be forced to make this decision is when Iran crosses certain red lines with its nuclear program. So three of the red lines that I point out in this recent Foreign Affairs article is if Iran enriches from 20% to the 90% HEU it would need to build weapons, if it kicked out international inspectors, or if it installs more advanced centrifuges in this facility at Qom. So that's a more technical reason. But all those things, I think, would signal that Iran is interested in weapons and that our ability to stop them is rapidly coming to an end. So, you know, it would depend then on how Iran decides to progress with its nuclear development. If it continues to go slow, to wait until it has everything in place, until it assembles, you know, we might be looking at, it's difficult to say, 12, 18 months until we're forced to make that decision. But Iran might not extend us the courtesy of time. The decision is really in their hands. And so it's possible, I don't think likely, but possible that they could announce this afternoon that they're kicking out international inspectors or enriching to 90%, in which case the decision would be forced on us at that point. So I think that it is time to start thinking seriously about the what is worse question, nuclear armed Iran or military action. And because if we're going to go the military action route, there's also a lot of diplomacy and groundwork that would need to be laid ahead of time to build a coalition. And I don't think it's likely, but it's possible that that decision could be forced on us today.
And following South Korea's participation in the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, I wanted to know if Seoul might send forces to help the U.S. if and when there was a conflict in Iran.
I think it ought to be when the time comes. I certainly hope it doesn't get that far. And as being a non-Iran or Middle East expert, I can, though, say that I can't imagine that we would be in a situation where it would be another Iraq, where the United States would invade Iran. I think that would just be a disaster. Having said that, I think the key distinction is what type of a military action is it. If it is purely a U.S.-led military effort, then I think, of course, it will be very difficult for South Korea to immediately join, despite it having a very specific security alliance with the United States. I think it makes a big difference on the type of military action in Iran. In other words, is it UN-led? Is it NATO-led? Is essentially U.S. one of the major supporters? That makes a difference, whether it's an international coalition effort or whether it's a U.S.-led effort. And I think with U.S.-led only effort, it's very difficult for South Korea, or for, frankly, any ally or any other country to join.
But in his Foreign Affairs article, Matthew Kronig seemed confident that any conflict with Iran would be over quickly, meaning the price paid by South Korea for oil would not spike for too long. I asked Kronig to explain why he was so confident that any conflict would be short-lived.
Well, I spent a year in the Department of Defense working on Iran policy and strategy, and so I went into the position, and many people on the outside were arguing that any conflict with Iran would lead to World War III. And so I kind of went in with that perspective. And then once I went in and kind of looked at, you know, what our options are, what Iran's retaliatory options are, I just became convinced that it's really hard to imagine how this becomes a major conflict. So if you look at Iran's capabilities, they don't have a strong conventional military. They've been investing in these asymmetric military options. So they only have really three ways of retaliating. They can sponsor terrorist attacks. They have a large stockpile of ballistic missiles, so they could launch ballistic missiles at population centers or at U.S. bases and ships in the region. But their ballistic missiles aren't very accurate, so they might not hit anything, depending on how many they decided to launch. And then they have the ability to cause havoc in the Persian Gulf and in the Strait of Hormuz. But as I pointed out before, if they tried to close the Strait of Hormuz, the U.S. military would completely destroy Iran's navy in a matter of weeks and reopen it. And so it's really hard then to imagine what this major conflict that people are worried about, how it happens. I think we do get terrorist attacks. I think we get ballistic missile strikes from Iran. I think that if they push too far in the Persian Gulf, that they'll lose their navy in a few weeks. But then it's hard to see how that then leads to a major war. I think the United States would be content to have destroyed the nuclear programs. We'd be content to back down. I don't think Iran in that position would want to commit national suicide by continuing to pick a major fight with the United States. So I think that that's the most likely scenario, that if the U.S. would conduct a surgical strike, that Iran would retaliate in these three, you know, serious but overall, I think, limited ways, and the conflict would de-escalate fairly quickly.
But not everyone is as confident as Kronig. Philip Yoon on the prospect of conflict.
It would, you know, economically it's bad news. It would enrage the Muslim population in the Middle East. And there are always, it's always not as clean and as easy as people say it is, and there are always going to be unintended consequences. That we know. So it's sort of the unknown unknown. I think the other point of this is that it would not really be necessarily effective. We know that that at the worst, at the very, you know, at best, an attack at this point would probably set back the Iranian program a couple years. And it's not a pinprick. Their nuclear facilities are spread throughout the country. And, you know, in a sense, we'd have to get all of them, you know, or a good percentage of them. And the other thing that I think we have to do is that if we're, you know, there is The general feeling is that the Iranians have not made the ultimate decision to move forward with creating a nuclear weapons program. Okay,
right.
If we attack Iran, if there is an attack on Iran, whether it's Israeli or anyone else, that is one sure way to make sure that Iran does become a nuclear power. I don't think that's my conviction.
One other impact would likely be that any attack on Iran would decrease the motivations for North Korea to denuclearize. I put it to Kronig that combined with the recent Libya conflict and demise of Saddam Hussein, any war in Iran would only extend North Korea's desire to hold on to its own nuclear weapons.
That's an interesting question. I guess the first thing I'd say is that I think denuclearization on the North Korean peninsula, as long as the current regime in North Korea is in power, is going to be incredibly difficult. They have very few bargaining chips. I think the small nuclear arsenal that we think they have is one of the only assets that they really have. So I think it's going to be very difficult to get them to give it up in any case. And as you point out, I think that they might judge, perhaps rightly, that without nuclear weapons, they would be more vulnerable to a strike. But as you also point out, I think that's a lesson that they have already learned. So I'm not sure that anything we do in Iran shapes the way significantly that they think about that, or shapes in any significant way our ability to denuclearize the peninsula.
In contrast, Philip Yoon had a different take.
I think that with respect to North Korea, it will just be one more talking point for them, which will they say, well, that's why we want a nuclear weapon. Okay. You know, when I was in negotiations with the North Koreans from 1998 to 2000, 2001, constantly citing to us, you know, if Iran, then they were talking about the first, Iraq war. If Saddam Hussein had a nuclear weapon, they would have never been attacked. They also talked about Milosevic, saying, you know, if he had a nuclear weapon, you know, no one would have messed with him. So I think that's one lesson that they would take directly from that. And I think to the extent that it would feed into their paranoia of, you know, ultimately what we want to do is regime change. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that would sort of cause them to hunker down even more. Again, the reality is that deterrence, works both ways. And for right now, North Korea has got, you know, substantial assets, both conventional and WMD. So, even though it's heavily in the favor of South Korea and the United States, you know, that's what it's all about.
So there you have it. All said, there appear to be many reasons why South Korea is likely to go ahead and reduce oil imports from Iran in the coming months. At the same time, though, the US has recently agreed to waivers with a number of countries across the world, including Japan. So there is still the possibility that South Korea may be exempted from these sanctions after all. And of course, if Iran really does increase its nuclear transparency, then the situation may even resolve itself before the costs are really felt at the pumps in Seoul. However, none of these situations can be counted on, so it seems quite plausible that South Korea will likely face increased energy prices in the coming months. I do hope you enjoyed today's podcast. You can download other episodes at our podcast website, which you can find at keia.podbean.com. That's keia.podbean.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could leave us some feedback using the comment system on either the Podbean website or directly on our iTunes page. If you'd like to suggest a candidate or topic for a future episode, be sure to drop me an email at ocarroll@keia.org. That's ocarroll@keia.org. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you can join us next time.